I want you to imagine that the miraculous happens over the Christmas season this year. Revival breaks out in Cheshire. Hundreds are saved, not just from Winterley, but from hundreds of surrounding villages. And these aren't just snap conversions, somebody who sticks up their hand on a special event, but they're deep and genuine. But the church here and other churches around cannot hold these converts. What would we do? Well, that's the situation that commonly faced Paul. It's a nice problem to have, isn't it? He went around the ancient world, preaching in town after town after town. Acts 13 to 14, for instance, tells of a journey where Paul and Barnabas saw many saved in city after city after city. But after they completed that evangelistic tour, we're actually told that they went back to all the places that they'd been before. And we're told that they appointed elders for them in each church, and with prayer and fasting committed them to the Lord. So Paul and Barnabas, and sometimes Paul and Silas and others, recognize the importance, first and foremost, of preaching the gospel to those who've not heard it before. But they also recognize the importance of going back and establishing churches with leaders that could help them grow in their Christian faith. Now, it seems like something similar has happened on the island of Crete. Many people have been saved in Crete. More than one town has a substantial number of Christians in it, as we can see here. It's not clear whether that was through Paul's ministry or someone else's. Paul seems to have been there because he's left Titus behind, but we don't know whether it was that he proclaimed the message or he just found these Christians there. But certainly Paul feels responsible that these young Christians are organized into churches and that they have elders and leaders to look after the church there. And so we read in verse 5, "The reason I left you," that is Titus, "in Crete, was that you might put in order what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." Strengthening was required, and as a result, leaders were required. Now, if you're aware of some of the things going on in the wider evangelical world at the moment, this topic couldn't be more vital. In the past few years, there have been dozens of scandals of fallen leaders in the evangelical world. By the internet, it's easier to influence not just dozens of Christians, but millions of Christians than it ever was before. So it is vital that we know what to look for in a leader. And that's why, especially since we're going very fast in the mornings, we're going to go slowly in the evenings. We're going to think about what these qualities of leaders are. Firstly, so that we might be able to put them into practice ourselves, whether we're elders or not, these are good Christian qualities to exhibit. But also so that we know the kind of people that we should be following in our Christian lives. So today we're going to be looking at verses 5 to 6. And in those verses, it tells us five things that each of us needs in our Christian life. Number one, you need leaders. Number two, you need multiple leaders. Number three, you need blameless leaders. Number four, you need faithful husbands as leaders. And number five, you need involved fathers as leaders. Let's look, first of all, at the fact that you need leaders. Some people live their Christian life detached from church. It's just them reading the Bible on their own. Why would they need a leader, an elder, a pastor? They'll say, "Jesus is my pastor. Why would I need anyone else interfering?" Perhaps more frequently, Christians outwardly acknowledge the need for leaders, but when someone actually tries to get involved in their life, it gets hard to accept. But Paul is clear that you and I, all of us, need leaders. When he says in verse 5, "I left you in Crete," he tells him, "You should put in order what was left unfinished and appoint elders in every town as I directed you." Now, it's hard to convey this in English, but in the Greek, that "I" is what's called an emphatic "I." It's kind of bold, underlined. It's emphatic. You're meant to pay attention to it. It's not just, "I happen to direct you in these things." It's, "I directed you. I, the Paul, who said last time, I'm a servant of God, I'm an apostle of God, I've been appointed to further the faith of God's elect. I, in that authoritative capacity stated that every town needed elders. This is not just some optional extra for Christians. It's not just some optional extra for those who are into organized religion. No, this is something vital for Christians all across Crete and all across the world now as well. You might be familiar with that word elder if you've been at our church for a while. You might not be. What does the word elder mean? Well, literally, it actually means an older man, which is why elder is a really good translation. However, age can't be the main focus because we know that both Titus and Timothy were quite young men. So the point is more that these are men who were older in the faith, mature in the faith. The word elder was used in Jewish synagogues of the people who were leading the synagogue, who were teaching the word. It's used interchangeably with the word overseer, which you see in verse 7, which is more of a Greek phrase, as is so often the case with Paul. He mixes up Greek and Jewish terms so that the people understand. So elder is just a term for someone who is a leader in a church. And in our church, that's myself, that's Simon, and that's Peter. These leaders are appointed town by town. There's not some overarching bishop of the whole island with various underlings, nor is there some celebrity preacher whose job it is to go from town to town. Each town, and thereby each individual church, has its own elders. Paul saw the appointment of such men as vital for the continuance of the gospel in Crete. And it's vital for you and I too. You need elders. Every Christian does. We are not called to go solo in our Christian lives. Perhaps it's easier to do so than ever. You can sit at home and watch famous preacher, listen to famous Christian band, Google the answers to all the questions you've ever had. Who needs an elder? But I guess it could have been the same for Titus's audience. Paul could have just wrote a series of letters. They'd have been no doubt better than any sermons these men could have preached. Or Titus himself could have gone on a preaching tour and been the official preacher for the island of Crete. No doubt both of these men would be much better than the inexperienced men that Titus was called to appoint. But the problem is that Paul and Titus wouldn't know this congregation intimately. These newly appointed elders, as they grew in their ability as leaders in the church, could guide this church like shepherds guiding sheep. And so it must be with us. Your elders here are not going to preach world-class sermons or give the best answers to your deepest questions. But in God's sovereignty, he's ordained the elders that you have, who will be held to account for your soul. And to flourish as a Christian, you need leaders. But Titus is not just told to appoint an elder in every town. He's told to appoint elders in every town. Plural elders, more than one elder, for singular town by town. So the second thing Paul tells you is you need multiple leaders. Nowhere in the New Testament is there an idea of a solo leader. If you look through Acts, you'll often see people going together. In the children's talk, we've seen Peter and John going off together. We see later in Acts, Paul and Barnabas, or Paul and Silas, Paul and Timothy, Luke, Titus. When we get to the church in Antioch, they name their whole eldership, and there's multiple men from different backgrounds and nationalities. Multiple leaders aren't just an ideal, they are vital for the health of a church. Now, many think that churches are led by the vicar or the pastor or the minister. Now, the Bible does teach that certain men, a bit like me, are set aside from secular employment to devote themselves particularly to teaching Sunday by Sunday. And the church supports such people financially to enable that labour. And it's something, obviously, I'm particularly grateful for. But that doesn't mean that the person in that position, the man in that position, is a solo leader. Or is above the other leaders. In fact, if that happened, it'd be incredibly dangerous for the church. So at our church, Simon, Peter, and I work together as equals. We each have different gifts. We each have different weaknesses. Now, we're not perfect, but the whole is better than the sum of the parts. And we try to avoid language that marks out that I'm some kind of special one. And so at the start of our service today, I said I'm one of the leadership team, not the pastor. Now, Peter's a pastor, Simon's a pastor, and I'm a pastor too. Now, whilst you might hear me preach more often, you shouldn't get the impression that I'm some lone wolf with Peter and Simon there in behind. No, it's a team of equals. And that means, encouragingly, that no one in our church is without an elder overseeing their souls. Each elder has two other elders to watch over their souls. So no one gets to fly solo. Isn't it a great plan of God that each and every member of the congregation, even if they're in leadership, has someone watching out for them? Let me give you two illustrations of this working and not working from church history. First, an example of it working. Many of you will have heard of Charles Spurgeon, who is a preacher in Victorian London. In his first 6.5 years in ministry, he saw 1,442 people become church members, over 1,000 of them having been converted under his ministry. So they weren't just coming in from elsewhere. Now, Charles Spurgeon believed very much in membership interviews and baptism interviews to make sure that people had believed before they were baptized. No one could have interviewed that number of people in that space of time successfully. But Spurgeon had elders working alongside him. And many of those men took a particular responsibility to work with those who'd become Christians, to check that they'd really been saved, to make sure that they were growing in their Christian faith. Spurgeon also suffered from chronic ill health and depression, we'd probably call it today. His elders managed his workload. They make sure he didn't burn out. They preached when he was away, resting, or when he was doing a wider evangelistic ministry. So many of us will look at the ministry of that church and say, Charles Spurgeon, what a man of God. But actually what we should be saying is what an eldership the Metropolitan Tabernacle had, each doing their duty. And in fact, there was more than just the members as well, the elders as well, but we'll get to that when we get to our women's ministry in chapter 2. The names of those elders are not as famous as Spurgeon's, but all those men were vital for the church. Now, contrast that with some of the recent scandals that have been going around the evangelical world. I won't name names, but one man was recently removed from a church for his abusive leadership. He had plural elders in name, but in reality, they were each a bunch of yes men with no real input into the life of the church. Any leader who criticized him was quickly pushed away, told to go on elsewhere. And eventually it got to the point where this one man was controlling the lives of his members down to the point of whether they could see their family on a weekend or not. It took outside pressure for such a man to be removed because there wasn't a plurality of elders. So if you ever move away from our church, look for a church with multiple leaders. An eldership that's truly plural should have times when the main teaching elder doesn't get his way. And there should be real on-the-ground ministry by each individual elder in a way that suits their gifts and calling. If you see that, you're seeing a biblical eldership. You need multiple leaders. Now, the next thing Paul says is you need blameless leaders. Verse 6, an elder must be blameless. That's a bit discouraging, isn't it? How could anyone live up to that demand? Unless Jesus Christ happens to be available to come and pastor the church here at Wheelock Heath, then we're not going to do pretty well on that front, we might think. Well, what does blameless actually mean? Blameless is a technical term. And it means someone that there is no evidence to accuse. It's like a case being thrown out of court for lack of evidence. That's the idea here. Some of your translations might say above reproach. There's nothing to accuse in a man. It's not saying he's without sin. It's rather saying they've done nothing to be disqualified from leadership. Now that word blameless comes in verse 6 and in verse 7 at the head of a number of different qualities. So I think what we're seeing in this whole passage is what it means to be blameless or what it means to be above reproach worked out. And today we're going to be looking at the requirements to be a faithful man to a husband to his wife and a faithful father to his children. And there's many other things there besides. Understanding what blameless means does give us a healthy dose of realism. Whilst no one would say they expect leaders to be sinless, sometimes it works out that way in practice. I remember hearing of one man who spoke to the deacons in his church, and he gave them a list of responsibilities he had in church life, to pray, to go and visit the sick, to prepare Bible studies, and asked how many hours he should be doing each of the things. Well, he got it back, and he wouldn't have time to sleep the amount of hours that were required. It was completely unrealistic. And sometimes we can all have unrealistic expectations of our leaders. And we don't expect them to be sinless theoretically. But actually, when they make mistakes, we struggle to recognize that that's par for the course. There's going to be bad sermons from time to time, especially at our church. There'll be bad pastoral counsel from time to time. There'll be times where sin is committed against people that needs repenting. Leaders should work hard to confess those sins and grow in both godliness and skill for the task. But the only sinless pastor is currently occupied in another position up in the heavenly courts. And it's a few years before he'll be taking over. Again, we must think of the recent scandals. Now, what has been missed is the act of blamelessness, the above reproachness. There's times where alcoholics have been allowed to pastor large churches and it's affected their health so much that they've committed suicide. Or an international evangelist who was never a part of a local church, never had any accountability. Or another preacher who's well known for his swearing and coarseness in the pulpit. We can begin to wonder, how could such men ever have been thought well of? Well, the fact was, there was a trail of genuine conversions behind each of these men. People saw their flaws but said, yeah, but look how affected they are. We need to overlook these things. Paul calls us here not to expect sinless pastors, but we should expect that where something is wrong, it is challenged, and that there are certain things that must not be seen. At this point, it's probably worth emphasizing that our leadership are all accountable to the congregation. I'd hope it would never be the case, but if there is a reason why we are worthy of blame, you should be seeking to remove us from leadership. That is important for the life of our church. If sin happens in an outward, obvious way, it should be confronted. And if it is a serious sin, the person should be removed. Now, at this point, we might be thinking, okay, well, where would you even begin to look for a leader like this? If you ever look through maybe your EN or your ET jobs list, or maybe you'd go on somewhere like the FIET website and see the jobs, you might begin to see some of the qualifications that are listed, the things churches look for in someone they're appointing. But I've never seen one begin where Paul begins. Now, Paul begins in quite a counterintuitive place. He begins in the home. First and foremost, you need faithful husbands as leaders. We're told, verse 6, an elder must be blameless, faithful to his wife. Literally, that reads a one-woman man. The Greeks didn't have separate words for wife and husband, so they're a bit like a Motown singer. If you're a woman, you'd call your husband my man. And if you were a man, you'd call your wife my woman. That means Paul here is affirming, he's assuming, male-only leadership. That's more explicit in 1 Timothy 2, verse 12, where he says, I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. She must be quiet. Now, that's quite controversial in our culture. I remember the first time I read those scriptures, it was controversial to me. I'm not going to spend a long time talking about this because it's quite tangential to our passage. But we should note that the Paul who says this is the Paul who speaks as a servant of God and an apostle of God. He doesn't speak out of some personal prejudice that needs to be deleted from the Bible. He's not giving a personal opinion. When he says, I do not permit, it's not just Paul, but it's the Spirit speaking. Now, that is both controversial and counterintuitive to us. Many of us will think, why should a person's sex define whether they should lead or not, when there's plenty of other characteristics? But if the word of God is the word of God, we must assume that God knows what he's talking about. There are plenty of important roles for women in the church, as we'll see when we get to chapter 2, but eldership is not one of them. Women's gifts aren't overlooked in that regard, but God has decreed, for his own sovereign purposes, elderships to be a male-only task. Now, what does it mean for an elder to be a one-woman man? Well, it certainly can't mean that celibacy is the ideal for elders, as the Catholic Church has taught. For the vast majority of men, they will be married when they're elders. And they're to be devoted exclusively to that one wife. Now, we might ask, what particular temptation is Paul expecting to be in the Cretans' way? In some cultures, polygamy was the norm, but there's no evidence that in Crete, in the Roman world at this time, polygamy was practiced. So it'd be odd if that was what he was talking about. But far more common in the ancient world was sexual immorality. I don't know if any of you have been to Pompeii. It's quite interesting to go there. You get a sense of what the biblical world was like. But one of the things they delight to do when they take you to Pompeii is they take you to the brothel. And as you go around, there's these rather lewd signs on the road to show the way for people visiting the town to get to the brothel. In the brothel itself, there's the most disgusting, explicit images in mosaics on the wall. And when I visited Pompeii, it struck me for the first time, this is what Roman society was like. People who think that our society today is immoral. Well, we have much, well, hopefully we don't have much to learn, but there is much the worse things that went on in the Greek and Roman world. And this temptation would have been before the average man in Crete. There would have been no pressure not to go to the brothel. There would have been no expectation that he would be a one-woman man. But Paul says that is not to be the case for an elder of the church. His wife is to be the sole source of his pleasure. Again, we only need to look at recent history to see dozens of men whose ministries have been ruined by inappropriate relationships. And sadly, with the high-speed internet, that's even worse than it ever was. It has become so incredibly common for men to look at images online that are inappropriate that researchers who want to see what the effect of pornography is actually can't find a control group of young men who have not watched it. This is how common it is in our society, as common as the brothel would have been in ancient Crete. But Christian men need to be above reproach. They need to have a greater standard. And this isn't just hinting of how a husband should not behave, but it's also telling us how he should. He should not just be a bare minimum of not cheating. He's to be devoted, a one-woman man. That's a good sign of what kind of leader he will be. There's often advice given to single women to look at how a man treats his mother and you'll see how he'll treat you after 10 years of marriage. Well, you could say to a church, look how a man treats his wife. That's how he'll be treating you after 10 years of eldership. All elders, all leaders in the church should make sure adequate time is devoted to their marriage. Of course, elders make sacrifice in all areas of their life, but Paul teaches that men who neglect their wives aren't good for the church. In fact, they cause more harm than good. And let that be a lesson to all of the men in our church. Do not think impurity can be excused because you're a fantastic preacher or a brilliant small group leader or you have some skill in other areas in the church. No, impurity must be fought against. It can't be overlooked. Do not believe that God is unconcerned with your relationship with your wife. This is so vitally important that Paul lists it as the first quality of the man who's to be a leader in a church. Finally, you need involved fathers as leaders. So we've seen you need leaders, you need multiple leaders, you need blameless leaders, you need faithful husbands as leaders, and you need involved fathers as leaders too. Paul carries on by discussing that an elder must be a man whose children believe. Or the footnote, children are trustworthy, we'll come back to that, and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Again, we're not in the theology college yet, we're not in the workplace yet. The place where a man, a married man's spiritual leadership is most on display is still in the home. We move from marriage to parenting. Now, the fact that there's a footnote shows here that the original is unclear. What it says in the original is a man whose children are faithful. But faithful to who? Well, if you write whose children believe, you're assuming that it's are faithful to God. But it could be are faithful to their parents, their father, in this particular sense. Well, let's look at the context and see what Paul says elsewhere to see if we can determine which of these is. Because it makes quite a big difference whether we should appoint elders whose children are all believers or whose children are all faithful to them. Paul says that these children aren't to be wild and disobedient. The word wild is a word that's used in the story of the prodigal son when he goes off the rails. So it's a kind of lifestyle of drunkenness, open immorality. That's the idea. And disobedience is rule-breaking. This could be clarifying what it means to be faithful to your father. And in 1 Timothy, there's a very similar list to this one. In it, Paul never mentions that a child is meant to be a believer, but he says that an elder must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him. Now, if he's writing the same sort of list to Timothy as he does to Titus, and if you know the passages, most of them are the same, it would make sense if Titus and Timothy are saying the same thing and not something different. Moreover, if we understand what conversion is like in the Bible, we'd be very suspicious of the idea that any man is responsible for his children's salvation. Jesus is very clear that it's not the will of a father. It's not the genetic line that causes someone to have new birth. But it is the will of God. It is the birth of the Spirit. And practically speaking, if you had this as your standard, it would prevent some very odd problems. What if a man has a newborn child? The Bible teaches that that child is born in sin and therefore not a Christian. Is he suddenly disqualified by the mere fact he's had a child? Or what if an adult child turns from their childhood faith? Is a 60-year-old father responsible for his 30-year-old son who doesn't live with him anymore? So it seems to make much more sense that it's not a man whose children believe, but a man whose children are faithful to him as a father. And that's exemplified by them not being wild and disobedient. Again, there isn't an expectation here that the children will be paragon of virtues with a halo around their head. Looking at this passage all through the week, I've been noticing every time my children are disobedient and wondering if I need to resign by Sunday. But that isn't the point here. Toddlers will still have tantrums. Children will groan about obeying their parents. Teenagers will push against authority. An ordinary level of sin will demonstrate itself in each child. But an elder will teach his children such that they're faithful to him and are not infamously immoral in their behavior. If an elder is the kind of man who refuses to discipline his children, there's a problem. As Paul puts it in 1 Timothy, if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? Parenting presents complicated problems all the time, just as leading a church does. No parenting or eldership manual will prepare you for every situation, but a man able to deal with the problems of parenting will, God willing, be able to deal with some of the problems that leadership gives. Now, the main point I said right at the start as we looked at this one was you need involved fathers as leaders. Where am I getting that from? Well, clearly the point here is not that the kids are being evaluated, but the father's care of them is being evaluated. That assumes that he's involved in their lives such that how they respond to him is going to be a reflection on his leadership. In our church, kids are generally seen as a bit of a nuisance that distracts us from the important responsibilities of life, like work. Even in churches, the raising of children can be thought of as women's work rather than men's. Mum will deal with the misbehavior and read the Bible with them while dad works late, watches Sky Sports, maybe prepares for his sermon on Sunday. But that's not the biblical view. Spiritual leadership is seen first and foremost in the home. Why does a man think he should have the responsibility to preach at a church every Sunday if he won't even lead a Bible study with his own kids? Why would he want to give marriage counselling if he can't even decide a debate between a brother and sister over who gets to play with the Lego? Why should he be called to rebuke a wayward church member if he doesn't know what to do with an impish schoolboy? God is much more bothered with the home life than with the CV. So, gents, if you want to be a godly leader in the church, as important as, perhaps even more important than having your systematic theology polished or your sermon illustrations on point, you should be a leader in your own home before you ever expect to be a lead here. So be teaching your kids regularly. Personally, I think you can't beat reading a bit of the Bible every meal because it's the easiest way for you to remember. But if you choose a different way, Make sure you're leading in your home. Make sure you're disciplining in a loving and caring way. These are things God requires from his leaders. So there we have the initial thing Paul wants us to teach. You need leaders, you need multiple leaders, you need blameless leaders, you need faithful husbands as leaders, and you need involved husbands as leaders. Now, quickly as we close, most of you here aren't elders. So what are you to take from this? Well, firstly, follow such leaders. These are the men we should appoint if we're appointing elders in churches. These are the churches we should be members of. It also suggests that such men can't be replaced by a computer screen. If recent scandals have shown us anything, it's important to state that it's impossible to tell online whether a man is a good husband and father and other things besides. The close-up leaders in our church are much less easy to hero worship because you see our flaws on a weekly basis. But that's a good thing. You get a clear perception of our lives and you can know whether we're men that you should be following or not. Secondly, pray for such leaders. I'm regretting already choosing to preach on Titus, as prayerfully examining my life in light of these verses is a bit of a humbling experience. I wonder whether you'd commit to praying regularly for Pete and Simon and I, and particularly in light of this passage, our families and our marriages, as important as that is. Thirdly, seek to be such leaders. These qualities are not meant to be some otherworldly standard of sainthood. They're meant to be the kind of men that are there in a very young church. So particularly for you men here, this should be an encouragement to emphasize in your life the importance of your marriage to God and your children to God. If God wants his leaders to be first and foremost husbands and fathers, then make sure that they have an appropriate priority in your life if you have them. And then finally, we should be grateful to God where such leaders exist. Ephesians 4 tells us Christ himself gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastor teachers to equip his people for works of service. No man fulfills these qualities by his own strength, but the grace of Christ and the work of the Spirit enable such people to exist. I don't mean by this that I'm expecting you to pat people on the back who've done a good job every Sunday or every time you see it. But I think in my own heart, when I have been sat under elders in other churches, my tendency has been to focus on their flaws. I hope you're not like that, but I suspect that's the case with you as well. Rather than focusing on flaws, we should be focusing on the good things that God has given us. Not necessarily give praise to individuals, but give praise to God for the way we see him at work in them.